I next met with Dr. Myron Chutchman to discuss NHL and CLL. And to begin, Dr. Chutchman commented on one of the most exciting new developments, specifically brentuximab vedotin.
With brentuximab vedotin, the SGN35, recently FDA approved. It's interesting, it's approved in patients with Hodgkin lymphoma that have relapsed or progressed after an autologous stem cell transplant, but also keeping in mind that the CD30 target, that it's an antibody with auristatin attached to it, and again, once it binds to the CD30, the Reed-Sternberg cell, where it's expressed, it will actually deliver the chemotherapy agent inside the tumor cells.
And incidentally, I've been told that this substance that's delivered inside is kind of similar to vinblastine. Is that true?
Yes, it's similar family as vinblastine. And that actually was just brought up. We had a discussion with a group of physicians. The one idea that you're asking about the future is where it may play a role. Well, okay, and not only, but let's just go with Hodgkin lymphoma after transplant, that's fine. But now they're going to be clinical trials looking at, can we get rid of, say, bleomycin? ABVD is curative, but people do get lung toxicity. Sometimes it's underestimated. And you have younger patients, and you know, a lot of them, you know, athletic or want to be very active, and we don't want to jeopardize that. So the idea was, one idea was maybe, instead like ABVD, take AVD and add the brentuximab vedotin. But then one of the comments by a colleague was like, well, wait a minute, you already got vinblastine and you're adding this SGN35 in a similar target. Is that really the best way of doing this? I think we'll have to find out. You know, I mean, what we don't want to see is that we get severe peripheral neuropathy because we're combining, say, two agents in the vinca alkaloid family. We'll have to find out. But those are ideas that are into play, is that how do we make things actually less toxic, not more toxic, but take away the bleo lung toxicity. It's actually probably a major theme in the future. We'll be seeing where we're going to be incorporating these exciting agents that work in the refractory setting, now more in the upfront. And the first group is probably going to be good risk patients, I would think, because they have good risk. And even AVD is actually quite active without the bleo from data that comes mostly from, you know, the German database, et cetera.
And, you know, we have heard that there is some peripheral neuropathy already that's been reported with B vedotin, but I can't quite get a feel for sort of how bad it is.
You know, I don't think it's to the degree, from my experience and my knowledge, say bortezomib. If you continue patients on bortezomib, you might develop, you know, you do develop, if you keep pushing it, irreversible sometimes, right, you know, neurotoxicity. It's not to that degree, but I think we have to have caution. We have to monitor patients, especially when these things open up now into the entire country. These are not just a limited number of patients on clinical trials. We might be seeing some differences in toxicities that we haven't seen yet. We'll have to be vigilant.
And we also know that this is approved in anaplastic large cell lymphoma. What other tumors or diseases are out there? Are there neoplasias that are out there that are CD30 positive that you might think are going to be responding to this agent?
The only two I know, Neil, really are the Hodgkin lymphoma and the anaplastic large cell lymphomas. Now, I don't know. I actually would look if they are, is it peripheral T cell lymphomas? There might be some that co-express CD30.
Right. That's
I'm not
what
quite
I've
sure.
Heard.
Yeah, there might be some. But I tell you, an anaplastic, I just saw an elderly gentleman that has not only significant disease in the body, just saw him a week or so ago, but almost like a cauliflower mass that was a skin lesion that turned to be very, very aggressive, that looks like it's going to be lymphoma because he has no other cancer. We'll see. We're going to start treatment actually with CHOP because he actually, you know, it's not approved for upfront therapy, but it's nice to know that he's got significant comorbidities. His heart is good, but he actually just had an open heart surgery. He's elderly. He's not a transplant candidate, but it's great to know that got, you know, B vedotin and down as a second line therapy for him if he does fail or progresses after the CHOP. Because other therapies that we have are less directed against the tumor and more, there's more nonspecific toxicities with those other treatments that definitely have less activity than this new agent.
Now, this man, did you say how old he was?
Yeah, this gentleman is in the late 60s, early 70s. It was weird. He actually underwent open heart surgery and they found some adenopathy. It's really a strange story. And after the surgery, they noticed that he had a little skin lesion near the incision site. And over a period of, say, about 3 weeks or so, the thing is at least 7 centimeters. It looks like a cauliflower-like mass. And you know, there's no question, and we don't want to waste time because it took a while after he recovered. He's now fine. Cardiac-wise, his ejection fraction's over 50%. Actually, it was that they caught him with angina. He didn't damage his heart yet, but they did the triple bypass. But this guy is actually progressing. We saw him a week ago, worked him up. Within a week, he's progressing further. So we're getting starting therapy. Just saw him yesterday. He's getting treated tomorrow with CHOP.
The tumor is ALK positive or negative?
That's an excellent question. ALK negative. And that's the other problem. ALK negative tumors, you know, ALK positive, CHOP may be curative. ALK negative, if you can, you want to take those patients, typically if they're in good shape, to first initial therapy and then the first remission, most of us would consider going right to an autologous stem cell transplant. They have that bad of a poor prognosis. At this point, though, I am just thankful, and I explained to the patient and family that we have brentuximab vedotin that would be at least a potential benefit for them, potentially, if we need to go to that.
Why do I think that if I had just had triple bypass surgery, I might not be wanting to get CHOP, particularly for an ALK-negative tumor? And if I had the money, maybe I'd want to take a shot at bevacizumab. I mean, I shouldn't even say this, but it did go through my head.
You know what? I guess if that was a possibility, but that's not a possibility for this patient. The question is, things are changing, you know, I'm sure, for a lot of people in the community, but also in academics. I mean, I think that the bottom line is things are going to be more restricted. Even in this area in Western New York, we have to get approval for off-label use. A number of policies won't cover things that are not basically approved unless we get a prior approval. And I think we're going to get more rejections for things that are not being following the, say, the approval. Now, the other thing that I've noticed is that the different insurance companies and providers are going to be very strict looking at the guidelines. And anything that is not on guideline will actually be questioned and maybe actually refused. So even in our cancer center, we actually request, for example, PET scans 5 days ahead of time to make sure that we get the approval for it before the patient has a test and then gets denied.
Yeah, no, I mean, there may be, obviously, there's a practical issue here.
Sure.
But, you know, when I think about the fact that you're about to give him a therapy that he's a lot higher risk for because he just had triple bypass surgery, and the therapy really kind of isn't going to work.
Well, I believe that he will have a tumor reduction. His tumor is fairly bulky right now, and I don't have a good handle right now that, for example, the brentuximab vedotin in a patient with really fairly bulky disease and also this large chest mass, that I still feel that CHOP is reasonable to start with. I'm very comfortable that if he has, say, a 70% reduction or, say, a PR, that, okay, I can then give him vedotin. And it actually may work better at that point, because my general experience is that smaller tumors do better with antibody-based therapy, maybe it doesn't have to be every case, than, say, something with bulky tumor. I think that's just a general premise that probably would hold true. Although you can see responses, you're better off. You have a better chance of working if you have a smaller tumor for, say, delivery to the tumor cells and getting a response than you if you have a very extensive tumor base.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, because I don't really know this, but I should, but what is the rate of partial response to CHOP with ALK-negative anaplastic large cell?
Yeah, anaplastic large cell ALK-negative. I think that the issue there is that patients will respond. The CR rate, I mean, I have seen patients achieve CR, and in a single institution, we don't have that many of these patients. The trouble is that if you respond, you don't respond for long, and you come back. The idea, that's the whole premise of taking them to transplant. So you can achieve CRs, and PRs probably, I can achieve a good chance I'll get this guy at least a 50% or further regression. The idea is that if you want to cure these patients, you need to take them to much more, say, to another step. That the CHOP alone is not going to be curative in the majority of patients. But will I see that tumor shrink? Sure, I'll see it shrink. But the thing is, though, if I wait a few weeks, months, it's growing back. And then I believe that any time we treat any lymphoma or any tumor and it relapses and it's not cured, you're developing more and more resistance. The idea there is that if you have a chance at transplant, maybe doing very high dose therapy, you overcome drug resistance and you may be able to get rid of that single last cell that will come back again.
So let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 70-year-old woman.
Yeah, we had a 70-year-old lady, and actually it was probably about 4 years ago. She had developed a transformed lymphoma from initially being follicular lymphoma and fairly aggressive and needed to go, actually probably 4 years ago, needed to go through an autologous stem cell transplant. It might have been even longer. Maybe it's actually 5 years now. And it was interesting because She actually was eligible, but we didn't have quite open the lenalidomide study for aggressive lymphoma subtypes. And it would have been transformed patients with follicular grade 3 or patients with, say, relapsed de novo diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and a mantle cell lymphoma. So she was actually debating, a very nice person, and had, say, the idea that, you know what, I'm waiting for the protocol, but I'm wondering if it's not going to work and I don't want side effects. I just went through a transplant 6 months ago. I'm thinking of going down and visiting friends, you know, I'm going to take a cruise and visit my friends in the Caribbean. So, and I looked at her and it was interesting because I said to her, well, I said, you can do that, but why don't you at least start the therapy and see how you like. You can always stop. There's nothing requiring you to continue treatment. And it was quite dramatic that in a patient that had very limited bone marrow reserve, that by going on to the lenalidomide, is that we'd actually went past three. She's probably was out 3.5-4 years on therapy. And just recently, in the last 2 months, finally demonstrated progression, biopsy showing large cell lymphoma. But to say that, you know, I wish it would happen in every patient, you know, the averages, say, and transform might do actually a little bit better than, say, de novo large cell. But this patient had a great quality of life, was able to travel, function. That we have to keep in mind, though, that patients are at risk for developing DVDs, that they have an increased clotting. But one aspirin a day, regular, not an 80 milligrams, but 325 along with the lenalidomide, 3 weeks on, 1 week off, she actually went several years in great shape. Now, we did have to adjust. We also keep in mind that with this agent, there's myelosuppression. So we did have to drop her dose down and just slowly drop it down. But we still had a great activity in this.
So you just actually reported in the British Journal of Hematology a differential effect of lenalidomide monotherapy in patients with relapse refractory transformed non-Hodgkin of distinct origin, 33 patients. What did you see there?
Yeah, it was interesting. In that scenario, the patients that had transformed lymphoma that came from a follicular lymphoma did better than those patients who developed transformed lymphoma from CLL, SLL. Not sure what pathway, what the reason for that was, but it was quite dramatic, the difference in the sensitivity to lenalidomide in those two.
And what was the dose of lenalidomide that in general has been used, and what exactly was used in this lady? How did she get dose reduced too?
That's a very good question. We started with the typical 25 in large cell lymphoma, different than people feel like CLL or maybe in other patients starting with a lower dose. We started out to 25 milligrams set dose per day, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. She did over a period of, like I said, over 3.5 years or so to 4 years, we did reduce her and we did have to go down to 20, 15, 10 eventually, but every few months, you know. At the end, she was on actually a dose of 5 milligrams three times a week, which is the lowest dose we could go to. And she had been on that for at least, I think, 4 or 5 months, because we did notice that, you know, it took a little bit. Occasionally, she would need some growth factor support. Very rare. She did not need and did not require blood or platelet transfusions, but the myelosuppression at the point after several years did require significant dose reduction. But seeing activity, we would be afraid of just stopping. And so that's the problem with some of these novel agents. For example, we mentioned before the CAL-101 or maybe the BTK inhibitor, and now also lenalidomide. Do you stop it after 6 cycles and say, okay, we're done? Or what is the whole role of a maintenance therapy? And I think that's different. With aggressive lymphomas, where you're not going to get another chance maybe, I think we'd be afraid of stopping it. We would continue it on. In a recent trial that we completed in the CLGB, we finished accrual for, was patients that had relapsed follicular. They actually got either randomized to lenalidomide alone or rituximab plus lenalidomide. And in that scenario, patients, we got 4 doses of rituximab and then lenalidomide, and we didn't stop. We actually gave, for example, a year's worth, like 12 months of therapy, and then we stopped with the idea that at least we have more chances with follicular, we can always retreat. Again, in a large cell or aggressive lymphoma setting that failed particular, for example, transplant, we're not going to get many options, many chances. The idea is, do we develop resistance by giving any target? You keep hitting that target, and this answer is not known yet. somehow that cell will compensate and upregulate that target, or it'll go maybe bypass the target and another pathway will become upregulated that will actually bypass that signal. So we have to use multiple, say, hitting that tumor cell and that pathway, maybe at multiple sites would actually be the best way of handling it. So the tumor can build a shield against itself in one place. It's going to be bombarded by multiple treatments with different mechanisms of action. That's going to be the future.
Can you kind of summarize what we know about the activity and whether you think there's a non-protocol role for lenalidomide in indolent lymphoma, CLL, mantle cell, and diffuse large B-cell?
The simple answer is yes, and I would say the role is that if you have a patient with relapse refractory disease, we have, for example, in the aggressive setting, two phase two studies, and now actually I'm the PI in the global trial. We actually looked at Dr. Hernandez, who works with me at Roswell, was the first author in a paper looking at the difference between GCB and non-GCB or the ABC, and seeing that there was a much higher percentage of patients with the non-GCB or the activated B-cell, diffuse large B-cell responding to lenalidomide than the GCB, which is kind of interesting because the GCB phenotype actually is the one that has a better prognosis at the beginning. But I believe due to the way the salvage therapies work with respect to potentially in the ABC, some of these agents, for example, the proteasome inhibitors downregulate NF-kappa-B and also affect cell cycle, which probably drive an ABC type of large cell more than the GCB. And also, for example, we thought about lenalidomide works better in the ABC, perhaps, because not only we actually have published that we downregulate NF-kappa-B, but it also has anti-angiogenesis effects as well. So based on the mechanism of some of these novel agents, some tumors actually have a better, say, ability to respond to the treatments, and maybe the ABC in the relapse refractory setting, and we're trying to prove that in the lenalidomide phase 3 study. There's two components. The first component is looking at 100 patients and being randomized between lenalidomide with ABC or GCB between either a standard dealer's choice, a single agent versus lenalidomide. And if it holds true that lenalidomide works in the ABC, then the phase 3 component, the larger component, will be analyzing that and trying to validate that further and may potentially lead to approval of the agent in large cell. So you're asking me in the community setting, if I had a patient that had failed a transplant and, you know, what options do we have left? I mean, I think that I would look to get off-label approval of lenalidomide, not only in large cell transform lymphoma, I told you this patient we just discussed, but I actually have used it in patients and got approval for, say, refractory CLL that failed even high-dose therapy. And also mantle cell, there's over a 50% or so response rate in those patients. It's been published. Also large studies, phase 3 studies being done in that group. So you're correct. I mean, can this agents be delivered to people in the community setting and not eligible and they can't travel long distances? Then I think it behooves the primary oncologist to try to get approval for off-label use for those patients, at least to try that agent for those patients. It's worth it.
Before we go into your next case, could you maybe, if you remember it, go through a little bit more detail how she presented initially in the very first diagnosis? She had what, FL in the beginning or what?
She had follicular lymphoma and she was treated in the community setting. And if she received like R-CHOP or RCVP, she had done well for a while, for maybe a couple years. And at that time, at one point, she did relapse. From my recollection, she might have been treated, or I do remember she had received at least like a fludarabine-based therapy, probably fludarabine rituximab. She responded yet again, but for a shorter interval. Say she might have had 2 or 3 years with the first treatment, or about 8 to 12 months with the second therapy, but then she had significant or more rapid progression of disease with adenopathy, made the community physician suspicious that it might be transforming. A repeat biopsy then showed large cell lymphoma. She was then referred to our transplanters. She received salvage therapy. I believe it was rice for 2 or 3 cycles, responded, went to transplant, but unfortunately within 6 months was progressing.
How old was she when she was transplanted?
We transplant up to the age of 75. At the time she was transplanted, she was probably 65, 66 or something in that age group.
No, there have been a number of developments since she was initially diagnosed, and we've talked about these in various education programs in the last year, but I just kind of want to get an update on where you stand with that. Where are you today in terms of non-protocol decision-making upfront FL?
I think there's a couple thoughts that I have. One is that if I have a patient that will require therapy, and they have, we keep in mind follicular grade 1 and grade 2, because that is the database, not follicular grade 3, that if the patient doesn't have bad prognostic factors, have a low or low intermediate risk flippy, my feeling is that why would I give them additional toxicity? Although we were the first to publish an R-CHOP, I use a fair amount of betamustine rituximab in patients that are not eligible for clinical trials, and I see very good responses. Now, I would be more comfortable if I have a final publication where I could review the fine tuning, the fine print, so to speak. However, there is no denying that many physicians, both academics and in community, are utilizing betamustine rituximab in patients with follicular grade 1, 2. However, in a patient with a bulky tumor, in patients that have B symptoms, in patients that have high grade flippy, I would not hesitate with considering the old standard R-CHOP, in my opinion, would be utilized because I've seen it work. And I know that we have a long, long history in a database that shows us that you have good responses. We should also keep in mind in follicular grade 3, especially 3B, but also 3A, because, you know, we don't have hematopathologists in every, you know, community hospital being able to maybe discern between a 3A and 3B, that anthracycline-based therapy is still or still should be considered the gold standard. So in a follicular grade 3, even though betamustine rituximab can work, that's not been published on, I would be using probably R-CHOP in those patients.
And how about if somebody said, well, you know, you're choosing a therapy that has an inferior response rate?
Then the question is, show me the final publication, and then I'll look at it a little more carefully.
Just checking.
Okay.
Just wanted to check, see where things were.
You know, it's interesting because you say, you know, is it inferior? Well, the question is, what is the long-term impact with betamustine rituximab, especially if we're dealing with younger patients? I mean, for now, I haven't seen it personally, but what if you have a patient you're treating and they have very resistant disease? Not everybody responds to betamustine rituximab, and you might want to be thinking of an auto transplant. So there's this question mark, are we affecting the stem cells and the ability to collect? Now, they did show that in a selected number of patients, not all patients were collected, but you can collect stem cells in patients, but that doesn't mean that every patient can be collected. And we, you know, how do patients respond? What is life after betamustine rituximab? Are you going to respond the same? The problem that I have is that we have a lot of treatments now. What is the best sequence of therapies? We don't know. Part of the thing is, with respect to the NCCN, we have the outcomes database that we've been accruing patients now for years. More centers are going to be accruing, and we'll be looking at maybe what impact the sequence of treatment 1 versus 2 or 2 versus 1 first will be in the future, but we don't have that information. So I think we have to be cautious that, you know, even though the Germans had it 20 years ago, they didn't save really much data. And I think the bottom line is we have to do what's best for patients. So I actually am happy to put patients on betamustine rituximab. I don't want to see people have significant toxicity if they can get the same result with a less non-toxic agent. But I think that we still have to be vigilant and still have to look at long-term effects, because we don't know until those things evolve, until we have the future at the present, we don't know exactly what impact. Things can change. What they appear to be initially can be different in the future. It can change.
The other big indolent lymphoma question that's come out there in the last year that I've talked to you about, again, just to get an update on your thinking, because stuff, you know, continues to sort of come out, is the issue of rituximab maintenance. So again, this is before this lady's time, but where are you right now with that?
That one, it's an interesting area of controversy in some ways. What I mean by that is that, I'll use the term, that not all oncologists have embraced the issue of 2-year rituximab maintenance therapy for all patients. And I think that we have to keep in mind a few things. One, if one evaluates the actual data, the PRIMA study looked at patients, they had to wait until the patient had indications for therapy. I would say to you that, you know, it's interesting, but they had significant tumor bulk. They had, say, significant disease. So that kind of patient population already skews you that if we wait till they have either bulky disease or cytopenias, they have a worse prognosis, probably require more therapy. I think I'll go on my soapbox that I would love to someday see a trial that will reevaluate earlier upfront therapy versus a watch and wait. So randomizing patients as they walk in the door that will be treated sooner that we wouldn't necessarily, instead of waiting until they're symptomatic, or then randomizing the other group to say, okay, when they develop these certain indications, we'll treat them, and then studying them. It's going to take a long time, but it's a very important question. Because if we look at data, patients with bulky disease, patients with a higher risk flippy score, for example, do worse. I don't care what treatment we're using right now, that seems to be a general theme. So the idea is, that is it just lead bias? If we treated somebody, for example, that walked in the door that had 2 centimeter nodes above and below the diaphragm, but they weren't symptomatic, and we just watched these patients for a long time, the question is, if I treated them now with betamustine or rituximab, for example, could I actually cure some of these patients that had disease that was early on? Oh, I get into good debates with especially European investigators. Well, that might be possible. We don't have any data. So let's create the data. Let's do the trial. But again, it would take a long time. We have to monitor. But in general, I think that that question is a very important one that should be answered. You asked me about 2 years of maintenance. I would tell you that, you know, the difference of that 16%, which holds true at 2 years, now at 3 years, that is progression-free survival. So the patients that are doing better, that 16% that has a higher, you know, they don't relapse as quickly. A lot of these relapses, and I don't know for sure because it's not documented, but my own experience is maybe a single lymph node. And they're scanning patients and picking up lymph nodes, you know, I don't know if it's every 6 months or so, but the idea is that we're getting away from scans. Is it symptomatic or asymptomatic? So it's, you know, almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy is that, okay, I proved they had progression-free survival, but overall survival isn't any different. And the real question is, if we look at data that was published in the past by Hainsworth et al., that if you gave rituximab maintenance versus just giving a repeat dose of 4 doses of rituximab in a time of progression, could we actually get the same outcome? Is a big question I have. By just giving patients therapy when they need it and not over-treating patients that don't need it. And we have to keep this in mind. In today's society, with pharmacoeconomics and the cost of a lot of these expensive agents, we don't want to overuse them. And there's another issue is that, are we potentially developing rituximab-resistant tumors by giving 4 or 6 cycles of rituximab-based immunochemotherapy and then 2 full years of maintenance, you know, 1 dose every 2 months? I don't know the answer, and that has not been answered by that database yet. I'd like to see that information where then I'd be more comfortable in making a logical decision. Now, if I have a high-risk patient, they're elderly, they don't have many options, then I will utilize rituximab maintenance in a patient I'm concerned will have an early relapse or so, but it's not utilized. It's not just a knee-jerk reaction for every patient.
So I want to go into your mantle cell patient, but I'm just going to ask you one more question to try to get at this another way. Same patient, you treat, you know, I guess when she presented with FL initially,
yeah.
Same woman, she presents to you today.
Yeah.
What would you likely use for induction and would you use R maintenance?
Okay, assuming that she has either grade 1 or grade 2, not grade 3. So let's say she has follicular lymphoma grade 2, that she has a fair amount of disease. I mean, it's interesting that there is this perception that I treat everybody with R-CHOP. It's not true. In fact, the NCCN guidelines, the database, not the guidelines, but the outcomes database, I'm right in the middle. I do take and I do watch and wait some older patients that have comorbidities or patients that have very limited disease. I still believe that patients that have stage 1 or 2 should receive involved-field radiation therapy as long as we're not going to the mediastinum or we're not hitting the gut, that those patients actually do very well. I would tell you that if she had 1 or 2 and she had a fair amount of disease to the point where I would treat her, I would give her probably betamustine and rituximab. If she had high-risk flippy or the tumor was, say, 7 centimeters, or even today, I think the new bulky, in my opinion, if you have a single mass that's 5 centimeters or more, I don't like it. Because our original R-CHOP data showed that people with 5 centimeter masses, single masses, had less of a chance of achieving a CR even with R-CHOP. So I would probably say that an older patient trying to avoid toxicity, assuming that they're in good shape, I still would go with the betamustine or rituximab, unless there were other issues that we discussed that I would go with, say, a more aggressive regimen.
I like that, the new bulky. And what about R maintenance?
Right now, there is no data. Keep in mind that the PRIMA was most of the patients were R-CHOP, but they had dealer's choice, R-CHOP, RCVP, or patients RFCM, more of a common German regimen. Nobody looked at our betamustine with or without 2 years of rituximab maintenance. That trial reportedly is going on right now in Germany, where they're taking patients, getting them R betamustine, then randomizing between 2 years of rituximab maintenance or nothing. I think there's another trial that would be very interesting in low-grade lymphoma, it's going to be R-squared, which is rituximab and lenalidomide, or R-chemo, randomized to R-chemo. And then the patients that got R-squared will go on to R-squared maintenance, and the patients that are getting R-chemo will go on to rituximab maintenance. That actually is very exciting. That's in the stage, I don't know if it's started yet, but that'll be interesting. So it's a different approach. I still have a question, does everybody need maintenance therapy? And what impact long-term does that have with respect to the tumor cell? I think that with other agents, actually the idea is that I would rather use something different than I use for my initial induction, because then I could use another, say, agent or drug or one of these small molecule inhibitors we talked about, that any residual tumor cells left behind, we can then maybe knock them out with using a very, say, exciting, new, novel, non-cross-resistant treatment approach. So it's kind of a unique consolidation to try to eradicate microscopic residual cells, not using the same therapy over and over again.
How about your 85-year-old lady?
And that was an interesting case. A patient presented to me, 85 years old, a grandmotherly type, sweet lady, but very fragile, had a little bit of an essential tremor, you know, had a lot of comorbidities, was functioning. She wasn't, you know, she didn't have renal failure, but she had a higher serum creatinine. She had hypertension, hypercholesterolemia, arthritis, had a hip replacement in the past. And she came in because she had a workup. She was GI bleeding, and they found that she had diffuse polyposis and turned out to be mantle cell lymphoma. But in addition to that, she had extensive or significant nodal disease, and she had all this, you know, GI bleeding. I looked at her, and I thought, no way that this lady's going to tolerate our CHOP. It wasn't going to be in the cards. And even our CVP, it would be very difficult. She was pretty fragile.
Where in the bowel was the disease?
It was all the way through the intestinal tract. In fact, they could see just multiple polyps all the way through the entire large intestine. In fact, she also had an upper endoscopy that showed she had involvement of the gastric mucosa with mantle cell lymphoma as well.
Wow.
So this was a tough case. I made a decision that also we had recently finished a trial with rituximab betamustine in relapse refractory mantle cell lymphoma. And the data was very promising that, you know, even patients that I had that failed a prior transplant, my personal patients I treated on trial actually responded very well. I actually requested and got off-label approval for, in this case, not to use the same agent, but betamustine rituximab actually I felt would be a good choice for this patient that had significant, not, we're not talking hospice, but I don't know if she was going to tolerate very much. And it was fascinating that she was bleeding when I saw her with, and I was worried, is she going to perforate or anything? She went through the first cycle, the bleeding stopped. After two cycles, I repeated a CT just to see where I was at, and the large masses in the abdomen and pelvis actually shrank down dramatically. She was actually had about an 80, 90% regression. I then went on to finish six cycles of therapy with her, and I actually believe in PET scans. I had done a PET scan pretreatment. The PET scan at the end of therapy was negative, and we had repeat colonoscopy and upper endoscopy that was completely clean. In fact, there were pictures, but we saw that there was no residual polyposis and random biopsies were negative, both above, you know, in the intestine and in the gastric mucosa. So essentially, she was in a CR, which continues for now about a year and a half now, but she's doing great. Felt much better. And again, it's really rewarding when you can help a patient like that.
And how did she tolerate the BR and what dose did you use?
Because of the extent of disease, I actually started with 90 milligrams per meter squared day 1-2 with rituximab 375 milligrams per meter squared on day 1 every 4 weeks. It also, it was gentle enough that at 4 week intervals, and I did monitor, we have to keep in mind, you can drop your blood counts. The rash is a very common side effect. She did not experience that from the betamustine. And she really, I never had to reduce her dose. I did make a decision to give her growth factor support, but not every patient requires that. But with her comorbidities, I didn't want to take a chance. I didn't know if she would actually survive a neutropenic fever. She never had neutropenic fever. She went through the six cycles, and I never dose reduced her. So she did extremely well.
And it sounds like she did not get rituximab maintenance, and we just saw some data on rituximab maintenance being presented in Europe very recently. What do we know about that strategy in mantle cell?
There was data, I haven't looked at it carefully, that rituximab maintenance in patients with mantle cell may have a role. And I think right now I'd have to look at it a little bit more carefully, but there was some preliminary data that I heard of that was discussed that it does prolong progression-free survival.
Because the one thing I've been hearing is, even though it wasn't presented, I think somehow it was known. And I've been hearing from investigators that the next, I think it's ECOG mantle cell trial, everybody's going to get rituximab maintenance, and then half of the people will be randomized on top of that to get bortezomib. One final question. How are you generally approaching non-protocol therapy of the patient up front with mantle cell who's younger?
I still believe that the data that comes from MD Anderson with rituximab hypercevad is actually a very reasonable therapy for a young, healthy patient, and that I still would believe that we should utilize it. I've done a little variation in patient that can be on protocol. Another idea that I think is very reasonable is that the better the quality of remission you have in patients, we believe that if those patients should be going to autologous stem cell transplant in first remission, is that you're not going to get them in 6 to 8 cycles of our hypercevet. So a small variation would be that I might plan to give them 4 cycles of our hypercevet followed by an autologous stem cell transplant. We say, you know, if you give more than 4, you might have jeopardy. You will have a delay in collecting stem cells from patients. So in that scenario I just said, if they're responding and say they had minimal marrow involvement, I might even repeat a marrow after 2 or 3 cycles, collect the stem cells, finish off with 4 cycles, and take them to auto transplant. That idea was proposed and is being tested right now by University of Nebraska. Julie Vose, I believe, is running that trial. I think that's an exciting trial. The whole premise is the better quality of the remission, in other words, the trouble with mantle cells, probably we're left with a lot of minimal residual disease, microscopic disease. It's not going to be picked up on a PET scan or blood work or physical exam. Is that how do we eradicate that minimal residual disease? And the better the quality of the CR, is I think a general theme we should keep in mind, the better chances that patient will have for either long-term progression-free survival or if we're looking at transplant for potential cure.
So really final question. So taking that, how would you feel about putting a patient on the, I guess it's a new study that's going to randomize patients to get R hypercvad or BR prior to transplant?
I think that's going to be a very important study. And you have to keep in mind that it really goes in some way against the general premise that, you know, the old school was more is always better. I think this is a very important study because it's going to tell us, for example, it astounded me that we had a lot of patients getting our hypercvad and getting, you know, really, you know, we're pushing the envelope or they're getting significant toxicity, whereas you can give those patients in the old days before betamustine some fludarabine rituximab and get CRs too, that a lot of things, patients respond to, the mantle cell responds to therapy, but that it was almost an opposite thought. Do we always have to give intensive therapy? And I mentioned the second case we talked about, an 85-year-old who's in remission after a couple years of just betamustine rituximab. I didn't beat her up. I didn't transplant her. So I think that'll be a very important question, that can we give a less toxic upfront therapy? And that's the future. And it'd be interesting to see if we're going to get equivocal or maybe better results with one or the other arm, is that do we really need to give a lot of toxicity to achieve our ends?
So does that mean you'd put your own patients on the study like that?
I would actually put my own patients on a study like that.